Tonight, it's my great pleasure to welcome Ty Ingrid Hazard to our stage here. We have had copies of her book, a relatively new book, I believe.
Hot off the press.
Hot off the presses. A Shaman's Journey, and she is here to talk about it. She is a Rinzai Zen priest, but has supplemented that interest, apparently, with another. And we're all looking forward to hearing about that. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you all for coming. I wrote this little book thinking that it would be basically for people who've done holotropic breathwork. These images have come out of my experience with holotropic breathwork. And the more this little book gets around, people come up to me and say, this is so relevant to my life. And I say, you know, have you done breathwork? And they say, oh, no, you know, never. But it relates to my dreams, or it relates to my love of fairy tales when I was young, and it reminds me of that. One person gave this book to her mother who was dying of cancer. And the mother said, you know, I've been having images like this of guides coming to help me, and I never thought this happened to anybody. And it was so comforting to see this somewhere else. And I think of it as a children's book for adults. And actually some kids have picked it up, and I was surprised to know that they like it too. So I'm happy to find that it has a big audience. And in some ways, it's a memoir, I guess, without writing 12 volumes or anything. It's a very short memoir of my life, sort of through the eyes of breathwork, which I've been involved in now for over 10 years. When I started the breathwork, I was encouraged to do it by somebody who had done it ahead of me. I'd heard of it, and I thought this is some new age thing that I wasn't particularly interested in. And this person said, you've got to try it. It's really fantastic. So I went to a workshop that Stan Groff was giving up in Vermont. And there were 200 people in this auditorium of a university. And I didn't know what to expect. I thought maybe it was something like the breathing that you do in Zen meditation, where we just sit around and breathe. Well, it turned out that it was not like that at all. Although, to me, it led to a similar kind of experience of a real deepening of who I was, going very deep inside, as one does in meditation, going very deep inside through this technique. The technique involves getting a partner. It doesn't have to be anybody that you know, just somebody that you trust. And you do it in two sessions. The first session, one person's the breather, and the other person is their sitter, and then you reverse that at the second session. And the sessions begin by music being played, very powerful music, drumming and music from different cultures, lots from Africa and India, and you're encouraged to breathe deeply. And as this happens, most people, not everybody, most people find themselves going into a non-ordinary state of consciousness. Some people call this altered states of consciousness, but Stan Groff doesn't like that term, because it's, when you think of something being altered, like an animal being altered, you're taking something away. But with non-ordinary states, you're very definitely bringing something to it. You're not taking anything away from it. And in these states, he says, as he's developed this theory, he says that you're open to a lot of healing, much more healing than you can get through talking therapy, because it goes much deeper inside than talking therapy does. For me, right away, my experiences were very visual, very definite, and related to shamanism. And I had been interested in shamanism, but I really didn't know a lot about it. But I learned learned a lot about shamanism over those experiences. I don't consider myself a shaman. Somebody asked me that, and I have a great respect for shamanism, and I think it takes years and years of training to become a shaman. And I don't say that I'm a shaman, but I will say that in those non-ordinary states of consciousness, I experienced shamanic events, and in many cases I felt that I was a shaman during those times. It felt to me when I first happened that maybe I was meant to be a shaman, you know, what should I do? And I talked to Stan about this, and he said, you know, if it's your calling, then you should follow it. I looked for people that I thought I could train with, and nothing really came up until I met a woman from Lapland. She'd come to the United States to give some lectures, and I knew right away that if I were going to be a shaman, this is who I would apprentice with. And she agreed to have me come and work with her. And about 6 months later, after she had gone back to Lapland, I got a letter saying that, unfortunately, she had died. So my... what do I do now? So I continued the breath work. It was very powerful for me, and I continued to have these images. And at some point, I thought, I need to put them together in a book, because looking at them as a whole for me gave a story that really enriched my life. And at the time I had the experiences, sometimes there would be, you know, one image here, another image there. During the next breathwork experience, it'd be kind of spotty images, but they didn't make a whole story. But when I finally sat down with the 118 paintings I had and looked at them all, to me, there were some stories there that gave a real focus to some of my life, some of the things that were happening in my life. And I thought these could help other people, either who were doing breath work or just people that go through life and have difficulties and can't explain some of the things that happen to them. So I put together this little book. So there's four sections, and there's one I'm going to read you, and it's very short. It's the second section, and it's called Healing. And several of the experiences I had in the breathwork showed me women that were involved in healing through plants, plant medicines. These all didn't come as in one breath work, but when I put them all together, it really gave a story to me. In the breath work, when you lie down and start breathing, sometimes you lay there and you think, well, nothing's happening. This is just ordinary reality. And as you breathe into it deeper and the music gets louder, you're really just taken off. Anybody who's done breath work knows this experience. At some point, you're gone, or you're not gone, you really come into yourself. And for me, there was often a scent in the air. I could smell something, even though there was nothing in the room. But I knew I was about to have a journey. So in this one, it's a young woman, and I'll read the text and show you the picture. It says, the air is sweet with a scent of rose and honeysuckle. The music is loud. The breath is strong, breath upon breath upon breath. The sky has never been so blue. I flow in a river of light. And this is the image that came of a young woman, shaman, with painted marks on her and jewelry with rings and bones. The lion comes. My guide holds me. I am dismembered. This must happen. This has always happened. If you've ever read Joseph Campbell, you know the hero's journey, and there's often a dismemberment at some point in it. And in this particular experience, I was dismembered, which was, in a sense, very painful. I mean, when you're in these experiences, they feel real. But in another sense, there is always this feeling that this must happen. This has always happened. This is part of being a human. And in different ways, we are dismembered, not particularly, you know, physically torn apart, but certainly you've been in situations where you're mentally or emotionally torn apart.
Did you have a choice in that experience?
No.
So you were being held.
Yeah.
Was it against your will?
No. And she was holding me to comfort me.
Okay.
And somebody said, you know, why didn't she stop? If she's your guide, why didn't she stop? But this is what happens. This is what, you know, you, a sense, your sacrifice, in the way Christ was sacrificed. Not the same, but similar. And then the cover here is, I rest in the arms of the great bear and am remembered. Turquoise pebbles from the moon mark the months of my healing. Wholeness rises up from the earth. And this is the cover picture, basically. And having that feeling of being in the arms of a bear, and of time passing, of the moon waxing and waning, and pebbles coming from the moon. And I had to count these pebbles, and when there were so many pebbles there, I knew I was healed and I could get up and go on. The plants call to me, yielding their names, sharing their spirits. The energy of healing grows. And this is one where I was in like a garden of plants. And as I walked through it, the plants would bend towards me. And as I passed them, they would whisper things in my ear. This is a shaman learning the secrets of the plants. The fire consumes, yet I will pass on the vine of healing. Another shaman, half wolf, half man, receives the vine. And this is an experience, past life or not, of being burned at the stake, and a vine coming out of the navel and passing that on, that knowledge on to another shaman. And this, I learned later, is the green man in England. Sometimes he's half animal, half man, and usually green, and he's the holder of knowledge of plants. Deep in the womb of the wolf, I am reborn into the wisdom of healing. The plants sing to me, the wolf calls. Green life springs forth again and again. So after that being burned, I woke up inside this wolf, and it was very warm and moist, and I could hear the wolf breathing. And then here I'm basically in the desert, but in this spot, I've drawn this circle around me, and in this spot, green is growing. And the wolf is singing chants that are talking about healing plants and where to find them. So that's the one section. There's three other sections, and I'd be happy if you got the book and read them all. I'm sorry about my voice. It's gotten very scratchy. I was out singing to the ocean yesterday, and I lost my voice. So people have asked me about that line that goes through all these stories about this must happen, this has always happened. And to me, there's a sense that the shaman, not just shaman, but people who really work for the world, sacrifice something. But in that, their calling is in that sacrifice. And they've always done this. And they're often people that kind of go against the grain of society, and it's difficult. So they're sacrificing something. And this has always happened. People have done difficult things, and people have been burned for this kind of stuff. So it's always happened, and it must always happen, because the cycle of life continues, and we keep pressing against things that tell us, you know, this can't be, this can't work. We're pressing against that, so it's always happening, to expand life and to push life further and further. I believe this experience is available to, I can't say everybody, but I think most everybody. People who are willing to go open that door into non-ordinary states of consciousness, this kind of wisdom is there. It's just waiting for you. And not everybody gets it in images. People get it, you know, intuitions, poems, or just different kinds of knowing than what you get in a book. Intuitions are what I call heart knowing. And in these states, I feel that we're much more open to the world. Our heart, our mind, our soul are open. And there's this tremendous knowledge, more wisdom than knowledge, that's come down from eons and eons. Through animals, a lot of these stories are about animal guides that help us. Through plants, through guides that some people might call angels, but some kind of an energy that's there to help us, that it's always there. And people have got it in different ways. You know, in the 70s, we all took drugs and got it that way. Shamans have fasted to get there. They've done drumming, different kinds of trance, entering trance through dance, through repetitive kinds of things. Drawing a circle on a stone for days. So there's all these ways to get to these states. Specifically, for me, somebody asked me, well, how does this relate to your life, you know, your day-to-day life? I had a very dear friend who was deeply involved in drugs and alcohol, and it broke my heart, and I didn't know what to do about it. And it was during a period when I was doing breath work, and I had these two images that I showed you about the wolf. And I did, after I had that breath work, I came out of it and I thought, ah, this is this person. This is the kind of healing that she needs. And I remember drawing that picture and sending it to her of that woman inside the wolf. This one. And that, you know, no matter what you've gone through and how you've been dismembered, this kind of healing is available. There's something in the world that will, it can hold you inside itself and help you heal while you get better. And then later, you know, you're going to have the energy to stand in this circle by yourself and talk to this wolf, communicate to this wolf. And I could almost see it happen in this person. The more I related this to her, and the more I would send her lots of paintings about, you know, strong women. And it felt like it worked in ways that the other ways couldn't. And then just other things in my life where I've been in really difficult situations. And I think of some of these images of the animals coming to help, of the spirit guides coming to help, and the kind of presence that is given to us when we're open to these states, that can really hold us together when everything else is falling apart. So that it's wonderful in the experience themselves when you're having them. They're very powerful. Although some people do get into places where it's painful, but the painful is always useful in ways of teaching. So to me, it's incredible work. It relates to the traditional shamans. I feel a great respect for traditional shamans. I've done some work with shamans actually since I've gotten involved with this, and it just seems like another path that I hope people will look into. It's not to be lost, and it's a great treasure there. Whoever wants to try it. Happy to talk to anybody about this, answer questions.
When you use the breath work, do you enter into it with a question perhaps in your mind or something that you want to know more about?
Not this type. Some breath works do, but Stan Grof believes that you go into it totally open and you're psyche, your body, knows what it needs. You might not know at the time, but your psyche does. So that you may think you're going in there. You know, you may have just had a big fight with your mother, and you think, I'm going to fix this, and something entirely different comes up. So you really just try to be as open as possible. Uh-huh. Yes?
Do you use the breathing techniques primarily to enter those different states of consciousness, or do you use other ways as well?
In the breath work, it's breathing. I've done some other things, some ayahuasca and some sweat lodges. And
but you use mainly the breath work right now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is the music an essential part as well?
Yes.
It's not just the breathing, it's that and the music.
And a combination, right. And a normal session will go about 2 hours, and the music changes. So when you start, it's kind of nice, and like, this is good, and then it gets stronger and stronger, and really builds up, and then at the end it kind of drops down. But the breathing really gets you to that point, gets you through that door, I would say, you know, of consciousness, and the music holds you there, so that once you're in that spot, then you don't have to breathe as deeply, and you can let go in a sense of your breath, and the music will carry you through.
Is there a technique to this breathing? You said you were prone.
Yeah, you close your eyes because you want to go inward. Some people put a mask over their face. You breathe deeper and faster. And it's what a lot of yoga's people say, don't do that, because that's what happens. You go into an ordinary state. Everybody doesn't. But
what's
can.
The role of the sitter?
To allow the breather to completely surrender and relax and not worry. If you need a drink of water, get your water. If you need a Kleenex, you need to throw up, get your bag. Sometimes there's a lot of motion around. So if somebody's rolling around next to you, your sitter holds a pillow off to protect you, that kind of thing.
So this can't be done as a solitary practice?
Some therapists do it alone with people, but it's not recommended. You can get into some states where you really believe you're a bird and open the window and fly out. I haven't heard of that, but that's what they claim.
Are most of the people's experiences in these large workshops of a shamanistic nature? Or do they
No.
have other kinds of, I mean, do they see angels or do they, you know, just see Yeah. guides? Is your experience typical?
No.
I guess I'm trying to say.
No, it isn't. Some people spend the whole thing seeing lights, just colored lights, hearing music, going to past lives. A lot of people have birth experiences during it. Some people, there was a woman in the training with me, in this 2-year training, and she came to all the training periods and breathed, and didn't seem like much happened. She didn't move around a lot, and we had a chance to share the experiences at the end if we wanted to. We didn't have to, and they would ask her, you know, what had happened, and she said, well, you know, not too much happened this time, and go on to the next person. And finally somebody said at the end of this 2 years, you know, Martha, you've been doing this training for 2 years, and you said, you know, not much has happened. Can you tell us about your experience? And she says, well, you know, nothing really happens, but it's totally changed my life. And that for her just to be in that space and to go, she felt that she went inside, but there was really nothing there. What I suspect it was, she went into that side, inside to that really calm space where you sometimes go, say, in meditation. And she did look different after those 2 years. She had a real calmness about her and real self-confidence. So you can't guarantee, you know, that you're going to get this.
Yeah. Especially if you're not an artist like you are.
Yeah.
What's the frequency of this work? Is it daily or?
No, usually, well, when I did the workshops with Stan, they were, you'd come out to California, I live in Massachusetts, come out to California for a two-week training, and there'd be, you'd have four sessions during those 2 weeks. And I was with a, for 10 years, I was with a group of 8 women, and every month we breathed that group together. So about once a month is what you usually do. There's a lot to assimilate over the, in one session. You need to really sit with it and let it kind of percolate through your system.
About how long does the session last?
About 2 hours.
2 hours. Mm-hmm.
Could you describe what physically happens during a session? Are you laying on the floor? Do you get up and move around? Do you sing? Do you do anything? Does your body do anything?
Yes. we really emphasize in these sessions that you feel safe, because I think to go really deep, you need to surrender. You need to be vulnerable. So this is kind of a process of the session, and ideally they're done over 2 or 3 days, so you have a time to get to know the people, to know the process, and then there's one session, and the next day there'd be another session. But so what happens when you're in this environment where you feel safe? It can be anywhere from 10 people to 200. Everybody lies on a mat on the floor. You've picked a partner, and you agree who's going to breathe first. So everybody gets settled on the floor, and the music is set up around the room, big speakers. And then Stan, the facilitator, kind of goes through a little relaxation, and people get, you know, their blankets that they may eat, or some people bring little talismans with them. And then the music starts, and you're encouraged to breathe deeper and faster. For about 5 or 10 minutes, you're told to breathe deeper and faster. When the music starts, it gets heavier, louder. And at some point, you look around the room, and people are moving around. You're supposed to stay on your mat, though. You don't want to, you know, be jumping up and hurting people. But some people can move a lot, you know, shake a lot. And you can feel the energy. If you're in a room 200 people, the energy is, you know, the building feels like it's raising off the ground. And then things slow down, and people are encouraged to go and draw something to get it out of your thinking brain, to try to get it into some kind of a picture in colors or shapes or whatever it can be. It don't have to be this detailed. And then there's a sharing session later. People want to share. They can tell what happened. Then the next day, you'd switch. The people who were the sitters would be the breathers. And the same thing would happen.
When you hear music now without the breath work, does it feel like something is missing?
I used to listen to that CD called The Mission. You know that? It was from the movie The Mission. You know? Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. It's a very evocative, rolling kind of music. And I used to listen to it in the car a lot. And after I heard it in breathwork for a few times, I put it on the car and I realized, no, pull over to the side of the road, get that off. So some music I respond to in that way. And some music, yeah, I want to lie down and breathe with it, because it's, you really get into it. And I find in the breath work, the music isn't just coming in my ears, it's coming in my pores, and my whole body is kind of vibrating with it.
Being a Buddhist also, I've been studying Vipassana for a number of years, and I've started reading some books on shamanism recently. But I was trying to figure out how the two intertwine, Buddhism and shamanism. Could you explain that a little bit? Because the teachings of the Buddha don't mention a lot of what I would call shamanistic practices, mm-hmm. but they both I don't know if they both go to the same place or what.
I think they do. I gave a little talk over at Jisho's Zendo a couple weeks ago. And the people that I know in Buddhism, when I did this book, said, you know, how come you're in shamanism? That's you're a Buddhist. And my shamanist friend said, I didn't know you were Buddhist. But to me, it's diving inside to the depth of who we are and finding out who we are and where we came from and what's all this about. And with the sitting, you know, it's a very quiet coming in and centering and getting yourself rooted there. And then it's hard to describe, but sometimes you drop into a space of deep, deep, deep wisdom. And in the breath work, you lie on the mat and you kind of, you know, explode out to the space, and then you comes all into you.
I mean, it usually, for me, to get to that, something close to that, I have to sit in a retreat for 10 days or something to do what you're saying you probably do in a day or two.
Yeah, it's hard. It's different. It's hard. It's really hard to say. Yeah. To me, they work together. And
does one help the other? In other words,
I think so.
Does your sitting become more powerful after you've done that practice?
I would say yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think a very strong commonality between Buddhism and shamanism is going to be the essence of compassion. I think those are very strong elements in both cases.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the whole sense of non-duality. It's always seemed a little abstract for me in sitting. That sense that, you know, of oneness. And in these experiences sometimes where I would merge into a bear, and there was no difference between myself and the bear. And there was that incredible feeling of, so, you know, we're all one.
If you're working with some important thing in your life that has you preoccupied, would you ever consider the breath work as a tool to help you get insight on that? And would it happen deliberately or accidentally? I'm correlating this to what you said earlier. It sounds like you don't know what's going to happen. You go in open. So that's sort of opposite of going in with an intent or seeking help on something.
Well, I had a teacher once who told me that nothing happens by accident, that everything happens by appointment. And I don't think there's kind of a one-to-one relationship, that if you have a problem and you do a breath work, that problem will be solved. But in the breath work, there are larger issues that seem to be opened up that then can relate to a more specific issue that's in your life right now. I'll give an example. I think just the expansion of one's mind to come out of oneself into another person or into an animal. And the feeling of that kind of energy moving from your body to another person's body. So that if you're in a situation in your work, you know, where you're having a really difficult time with one of your fellow employees, you might, when next time you see that person, you might actually feel some of that energy going back and forth. That, you know, we're not that different. We're not two people. But we share, you know, a common Buddha nature, and we share a common feeling.
Does it seem to you, when you're in a session, do you have a sense that you're being held by something that's perhaps larger than your normal sense of self?
Yes, I do. Although it's not separate.
Not separate.
Yeah.
But not accessed the same way as it might be in your ordinary state.
Yes,
of consciousness.
Yes.
Does this guide the session in any way?
The sessions really vary. Sometimes there is, it seems like there's a kind of a a carrier wave that, that goes through it. In other sessions, it just seems like it's bang, 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 one thing after another. It's hard to tell. But the more you do, and the more I've done, the more I can see patterns. It's just teaching me something. Listen up.
So now when you go to a silent retreat, you go down to Olima for 5 days, and you're doing primarily Zen kind of practice, you're doing a silent meditation practice. Do the shamanic experiences from breath work filter in they, experientially they're kind of different paths. You know, there's an underlying commonality. But so in the experiential path of your Zen practice in a retreat setting, do the experiences of the shamanistic side come in dreams or in image or in experience, or do the experiences as paths stay somewhat separate?
They get mixed up. I was down in Lima a couple weeks ago sitting, and it was uncomfortable. My legs hurt, and I was grouchy. And I just said, you know, just sit here. It's all right. Just sit here. And I got this image that I had had in a breathwork of myself, younger. They're always younger in here. Naked, riding a tiger. And that image came through, and I sat up straight, and my knees stopped hurting, and I just sank into the sitting. And it was like this. I don't know if it was if the tiger came by, something came into me that made me realize who I was. I'm not just, decrepit old person that's aching, but something inside me is willing to sit up and pay attention. You have a question?
I'm so curious about the music. Is this... Was it something that Stan Grof developed? I mean, is there? You were talking about the mission. Who's the DJ for this thing? Is there like a regular musical program? I mean, it sounds like it's really important.
It is. It's a good question.
And as you've done so many different sessions, who decides what music to use? And does it keep changing? And do you progress through different elements? How? I'm just curious how it's selected.
It's very important. For a long time, Stan's wife, Christina, did the music. She was really good. A lot of it comes out of shamanic work from other countries. We do a lot of Olatunji drumming. Do you know Olatunji? Drumming. And there's a monkey chant from, I think it's Indonesian monkey chant. Do you know that one? Bali monkey chant. And the Guto monks chanting. Some stuff from Inuit cultures, drumming and chanting. They try to get no English in there because the words are going to distract you, but some stuff that might be in some other languages. And it's very important. Sometimes I've gone to a couple of sessions where the person doing the music is kind of not with it, and it can kind of drag you down. And then if you do breath work a lot, you really don't want to hear the same program over and over. It's not too critical, but it's nice to get new music. So some of these people are really into the music, and they're all the time, checking out new pieces and putting together different programs. I like to put together my own program with separate, CDs, but some you can get them all made up that way. Holotropic Breathwork. And it is important, and there's certain pieces that I know if I hear them, I'm there, that's kind of my the door opens and I go in. So we're always looking for different things.
And are there practitioners out here that work with people doing that?
Oh, yes.
Or you always have to get in a group?
There's some therapists who do it one-on-one with people who've had so much trauma that they can't be in a group. But it's pretty labor-intensive, to be that you're spending 4 or 5 hours with somebody. And I love the group energy. The bigger the groups, you can feel the energy.
Are there local groups?
I'm sure there is. There's Bay Area Breathers, I think, in San Francisco. There used to be somebody in San Anselmo. But I think if you look on the web, you'll find people around. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it like listening to a concert, but through the breathing, you get to like be the concert more? So you experience. So it's like a more experiential thing of listening or being with the music or in the music or the music itself. It's a joint. The breathing becomes a kind of a joining with the music.
Not really. The music
is it joining with the breathing?
After I just said the music is important, music isn't important. it's important in that, you know, that it moves you. But as I said earlier, the breath really gets you into that non-ordinary state, and the music holds you there. So you're really, in a sense, you're not listening to the music, but you're sure aware of it, and you're almost feeling it in your body, you know, more than hearing it in your ears. Although some people, I think, who are musically inclined, do get more attached to the music, and that carries them more. So it's not like going to a concert, even a rav.
So it's a range. There's a range of relationships with the music versus the...
Yeah, I think in the beginning you're probably more aware of it. And then for most people, and for me, I find that you go into a non-ordinary state and you may have some very intense experiences, images I usually have, for like 15 or 20 minutes. And then you kind of slip back a little bit into an ordinary state. But if you, again, if you at that point, if you start breathing again and focusing on the music, you can go again, you know, kind of into another stage, so that it's, you know, a little bit like this. But then again, it varies with people. Sometimes I've gone into a state and I've stayed there for, you know, 2 or 3 hours with no breaks. So the music has to allow for all these different ways of being in it.
You start with the breathing, and then the music is added. And is the music constant throughout, or are
yes.
there pauses?
No, the music is constant throughout.
Yeah. But there are changes.
Yes, although within each section, there's not a lot of change. I mean, if it's a really loud driving music of drums, then the next piece will be a loud driving music of, you know, chanting, and then later when it slows down, then each of those pieces is kind of a slow, quiet piece.
I think there have been dramatic remissions of like cancer just from sessions.
There's been a lot of mental healing. I don't know about physical healing. There was a case of a woman who actually saw this. She had been a pianist for many years, and she got in an accident and hurt her hand, and they said she'd never play the piano again. And it was, you know, a little bit sort of bent. And she went into a breath work, and the whole breath work was kind of like this. And when she got done, she could move her hands in ways that she could never move them before. It had opened some channel for her. And it stayed. I checked with her later and it stayed.
Could she play the piano again?
I don't know, but she was going to try.
I had two thoughts. One was, you know, talking. I'm not hung up on the music. I'm just really interested in it. And I would wonder, had you ever played with, did you ever breathe with live, like people actually drumming as opposed to recordings? And because there's so much energy when you hear a live concert versus
music. We did have some drummers once.
Yeah, and was it really different?
It was good.
And then my next question is, do you dream of shamanic images? And if you do, and if you recall the dreams, are they similar
to the kind of visions you have during home, the breath work?
I feel I was very lucky in that my mother recorded a vision I had when I was 4 years old. I had scarlet fever, and I guess it was a delirium, and I had a vision then that I told her, because I thought it was real. It seemed normal for a four-year-old, and she wrote it down, and I remember reading that later, and it was a very much like a shamanic, one of these shamanic experiences. And yeah, some of my dreams are, these people come through my dreams.
Have you ever had a feeling of not wanting to return?
Yes. But there is a sense of bringing it back.
Yeah.
You can't just keep it yourself. You've got to share it. Yes?
Could you describe your ayahuasca experience?
Well, I was. I heard about a very powerful shaman that was coming to my area, and I knew the man who was apprenticing to him, and he said, "Why don't you come?" And I was something told me I should do it, and so I went, and it was a very powerful ritual that came out of this tradition. He was a shaman from Colombia. His father had been a shaman, his grandfather had been a shaman. And ayahuasca is a very powerful holy plant. And the people who were doing this, I trusted and I felt good with them. So there are about maybe 40 people. And it's set up as a very spiritual experience. And you drink ayahuasca for the vision. And the plant is your teacher. And it's a little bit like a near-death experience. It cleans you out physically and mentally. And I think if one were to follow that path, there's a tremendous amount to learn there. It was a little brutal for me. It's hard on your body, but it's a real path if you have a real shaman. And some of the things that he did, I can't explain. And I think there's fields of energy available to some people that they can move that. It's hard to describe it because it's they have other powers, and it's a real path. If you're interested, you should look into it.
What was the name of the teacher?
The who?
What was the name of the song?
Oh, Enrico Hernandez. I think there's quite a few out in the West Coast. Do that path.
There's a lady that puts on events in ayahuasca in the town.
Here?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. She trained in South America?
I'm not sure which other source is. They also do it in Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was connected with the Santo Daime group in Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh, yes.
For a while.
Yeah. Their form is a little bit milder, isn't it?
Not it.
Their form is a little milder, isn't it?
The form?
It's a form of ayahuasca that's purified, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Ayahuasca is made from the leaf of one plant and the root of another.
Right.
Or the vine, I'm sorry. The
but
vine
there's different one. There's different mixtures, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did it make you really sick?
Sometimes. but it felt cathartic when it happened.
Yeah, it does.
It was like getting all the stuff out.
Yep. Yeah. Mm. I urge you all to try breath work.
And that would be with Stan, right? Through the...
There are other types, but I say his is the best.
His is the best.
Yeah.
He still does trainings, or does sessions.
Stan himself, he had a heart attack this winter.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. So I'm not sure what he's doing right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But
his group is still going. Yeah. Where is
he?
He lives in Marin, but the I think their headquarters is in San Rafael, maybe. It's check it on the web, holotropics.com, or holotropic breathwork. Some of you have done it, right? Holotropic.
H-O-L-O.
Yes. Wholeness. Turning towards wholeness. Holotropic.
H-O-L-O, not W-H-O-L-O.
I find that the experience can also be gotten by deep hypnosis.
I don't know, but you say? Yes?
Yeah, it's maybe less intense, because usually it doesn't last maybe 2 hours, and you don't need to do that in large groups, although it does help when you do, but I think you can go incredibly deep and far wide, but in that case you can actually enter it with a specific question in mind. And
does that specific question get answered?
Well, perhaps it's possible. Maybe not in a specific way, but in more general way.
Is this self-hypnosis or is this?
It could be done as self-hypnosis, but it's also nice if somebody else does it with you. It's almost like self-hypnosis, almost like giving yourself a massage. It's a little harder to get to that depth, I think. You need quite a bit of practice. But doing it with somebody else who guides you is a little easier. But I found that the experiences were fairly similar. Maybe less intense.
I always go for intensity.
Yeah.
Unless it makes you physically sick.
Well, unless that was intense or just... I would say that the ayahuasca experiences were, for me, not as intense because I probably couldn't totally surrender. It was too hard on my system physically.
What do you think is the difference between... people ask me that sometimes. But if you do LSD, some of us have done that maybe in the past. what is the difference between that experience and the holotropic breathing experience or deep hypnosis? I think there is a big difference. What is your... There is a difference, I think.
It's illegal.
Yes.
But that didn't stop us, did it?
No, it didn't stop.
I've had some similar experiences on peyote.
Right.
But I think for me, there's a lot of it is intention. Like with the ayahuasca, it's a very specific ritual, and it's set up in a situation that's very respectful of the tradition and all. And the breath work has that sense to it that you are specifically going there to go in this inner journey, and you've agreed with all these people to do it. And I suppose drugs can be done that way, but usually they aren't. You pop a drug and you're off. But the breath work seems somehow more
organic, maybe?
Maybe organic. Maybe that's the word. It's not imposed on you. You're willingly going in. If you're taking acid, it's no choice. You're just there.
It takes you there.
Yeah.
You're making it happen when you use
your
breath. Yeah. I find those experiences more memorable than...
And they last longer. Mm-hmm.
They last longer. Yeah.
Did you find the same teachers or animals coming to you all the time? I mean, would you recognize, I've met this animal before? Or
Yes, yes and no, but because they always seem new. And I had a stage where I had hawks and eagles, and then that went away, and I had bears and wolves. But they all come with the same kind of presence. They come with a, you know, I'm here to tell you something. And I'm here to take care of you, and incredible sense of awe and nurturing, even though they might be tearing you limb to limb. It's like maybe what some people think of as a, you know, a guardian angel, but they don't suffer fools gladly. They can be very raw when they come, but very healing.
Did you also meet humans?
Yeah. Usually a Native American or a Inuit woman. Mostly more women than men, although sometimes in his experience I was a man.
And is it different in shamanic practice? There's the three worlds. Do you have any sense of that when you do this kind of work?
Not as much so, no. But I did have some that were underground, several that were underground, yeah.
What distinguishes a shamanic experience from other types of experiences?
That's a good question. For me, they came in this context of having animal guides, having experiences of sacrifice, of, you know, drumming or dancing or going into trances. And when I checked later, in the literature, I found that these actually did happen in shamanic cultures. These were techniques they used to go into trances. These are how shamans were taught. And they seem to be, the images to me seem to be what I would call shamanic. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. I'm very much appreciated. And thank you all for coming tonight. Just a quick observation that we have copies of Ms. Hazard's book here for you to look at and hopefully purchase, as well as other books about shamanism. We have a donation bowl over there on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute to it, which we share with the speaker and use as well to maintain this space for upcoming events like this and more. So thank you so much. Thank you.